Please join me in welcoming back director of Norm Woodcraft, everybody. Amazing work. Congratulations. Thank you for the film. I just had pulled this quote from an interview you did, I think around the time the film was released at Sundance. The sensitivity of the issues in this film added a level of stress and anxiety that I've never experienced. Maybe tell us a little bit about that and why this film might have been so scary to make for you.
Actually, there were a lot of secrets involved in this film. Some of them I can't actually talk about. I mean, we had to stay super under the radar to make it, both in Yemen and then with the US government. And just you know, to make this film, we couldn't always tell everyone everything that was happening to get it made, because it wouldn't have gotten made otherwise. And it wasn't just me who sort of took on that stress, but also my collaborators. So Jonathan Oppenheim and Kirsten Johnson, who did the Guantanamo shoot, and just never knowing if we were going to get a knock on the door, you know? And then on top of that, the sort of what is, you know, working in Yemen, making, you know, a film about someone who's Ben Laden's bodyguard, just, of course, was, you know, stressful. So all those things, but just, there was a kind of a paranoia that sort of pervaded the making of the film, and it still kind of, you know, hovers around. You
know. Well, backing up just a moment, did you go to make a film about Abu Jandal, or was it another? How did you come to meet him, I guess?
I actually met him somewhat by accident. I mean, I went to Yemen, not by accident. I went to Yemen because I wanted to make a film about Guantanamo, and there are a lot of Yemenis at Guantanamo. There still are a lot of Yemenis at Guantanamo. And I was looking for a story of new returnees, so somebody gets released and going home. And that was the sort of, I thought, okay, I want to understand that story. And then I got to Yemen, and we were working, I was with a lawyer who represented several detainees, and we were asked, do you want to meet Sanam Hamdan's family? And I knew Sanam Hamdan was at that point, you know, one of the most well-known Guantanamo prisoners, along with Omar Khadr. I said, of course, I wanted to meet him, and then this is who I was introduced to. And so, you know, it was pretty instantly fascinating. This guy who was Bin Laden's bodyguard, who drives a taxi cab in Yemen. I mean, just this, sort of the levels of, you know, questions that raises. You know, why is he free at Hamdan's in Guantanamo? He was the one who recruited him. And then it was after that I'd read, Lawrence Wright has an amazing book called The Looming Tower, which deals with Al-Qaeda and ideology. And he talks about this interrogation in Ali Sufan. So I had read that story, but I didn't put it together until I got back home. And it's like, oh, okay, on top of the fact that he was Bin Laden's bodyguard, recruited Hamdan, he was also interrogated for less than a week after 9/11.
Was it difficult to get him to agree to tell his story?
I mean, as you can see, as we try to show in the film, he's not shy about talking to the media. So you know, that's part of the story. And so it's like, but we needed something different and deeper. And so it wasn't, I mean, and I think that the thing that helped the most is I showed you the film I made in Iraq. And so, having spent time there and filming that, so I think that kind of allowed me to get the sort of more different kind of access. But for instance, like, you know, from the first time I met him, I said, can I put a camera in your car, you know, the taxi cab, because I knew that this was just, you know, going to be an amazing sort of way to supposed to explore him psychologically and how he interacts and sort of this spiraling through line. And, you know, I asked him the first time I met him, so how about next week, you know? And it took probably about a year before I actually had a camera in the taxi cab.
A story like this can be told, obviously, in a number of different ways. It doesn't have a point of view. As I said, I see it as being something that's very sort of more cinema and ambiguities. Was that something that was difficult for you to make, or you know, you shoo and you don't explain too much to us, and we have to work our way around it? Tell us a little bit about your filmmaking style and approach.
I mean, I think that is actually a point of view. I mean, what we want to do is present somebody who is complex and contradictory and let you guys kind of figure out, you know, some things about it. But we did make some very, very conscious decisions. And Jonathan Oppenheim, the editor, I mean, we wanted it to be sort of a psychological mystery. Like we always felt there was a secret there. And that we wanted to slowly, like his backstory to slowly unravel. So to sort of enter it at the present tense, which is, I typically do, you know, verite drama unfolding. And that, you know, then we slowly reveal his backstory. And that was always his thread. And then with Hamdan, we really were interested in this idea of a ghost, like somebody who's missing and whose absence is evoked. And so then And that's just hard. I mean, Guantanamo is still, I mean, there are people there, have been there since 2002. And so how do you deal with this material that kind of goes at a more emotional level than just the information? Because we all know that people are being held there, but there's not sort of an emotional thread. So it was actually a very constructed sort of narrative film. So in a sense, yeah, he was always sort of understood as a ghost, and then Abu Jamal, we wanted to slowly reveal his story, because he doesn't tell, you don't know it all. He's not gonna, like, there are certain things that he doesn't reveal to us, so we wanted to construct that.
Has Hamdan seen the film, Nina?
Abu Jamal has? I don't think so. Hamdan has.
Jamal's reaction.
You know, I heard contradictory responses. First, I was hearing some very troubling, he was upset, and then I think it was before he'd seen it, and then he saw it, and then he seemed to be okay with it.
Interesting. Well, I'm happy to take questions from the audience that have just seen it. I want to start down here. Go ahead.
Where do you see the Cotter trial going based on your experience?
Say that again.
Where do you see the Cotter trial going based on
Cotter trial? Okay, so Carol Rosenberg sent me an email while the screening was happening. What she said is that he's been boycotting the trials. But what, from my experience, is that it's a disaster in terms of trying to create military rule on the fly. And so what Cotter is being tried, and there have been now three sets of laws around military commissions. It was the first one, and which was struck down by the Supreme Court case, the Hamdan case. And then there was a new version that Hamdan was convicted of, where new charges were created after, well after the fact. And then this version, the story that I've been hearing, that's sort of the most absurd story, is that on Tuesday night, the journalists and the defense team finally got the manual for the Military Commission Act of 2009. And, so they're like writing it as they go, and then there were things that were left out of it. So for instance, there was a question whether or not you could plead guilty to a capital crime to a judge, which was just kind of left blank. And that's the big case around Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, because they've been wanting to plead out. And then the other thing is this new version of the military commissions, which is the Obama version, now the judge is not allowed to sentence time served. So you're not allowed. So with Hamdan, what happened with him, which was, time served plus 5 months, is no longer an option for judges. So I mean, I just think it's a disaster. I mean, I think, with particularly the 9/11 trials, why is the United States trying to use a system that hasn't withstood legal scrutiny? You're going to give defense lawyers the rules for the court process the day before the trial begins. So I think it's very frightening. But what I also think is that, in a very ironic way, Hamdan, because they were a military jury, I think they also understood things like chain of command. And that when you look at war crimes, I mean, there always is a question of, like, who are the really architects and who are the foot soldiers and who are the people that are to be brought at the level of war crimes. And I think that's what sort of the evoking Nuremberg relates to. So, they didn't, there are a lot of people who are culpable, but those aren't necessarily the people that should be brought before war crimes. So.
Go ahead.
About the letter at the end, and what's there, where Hamdan is upset, what's the relationship today, and how is Abu Jamal doing now? They think that they disagree, but they're family, and so I think they spend Fridays together, but they obviously clearly chosen very different ways of sort of being in the world around these issues, and so I think he's still I think he just wants to be a private person, and he didn't ever want to be elevated to this kind of fame, if that's what you want to call it. And in terms of Abu Jamal, I think he's trying to get by. I think he was collaborating with someone to try to write a narrative book version. But I think he's in a very difficult position, because it's very hard for him to get, employed. So I think that's continuing.
Go ahead, Darren. Why you wanted to make the film, and your original motivation, and guess, point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that here was a way, like, by following these two stories, Hanban and Abu Jandal, that you could understand so much of the, you know, post 9/11 world. So if that's both the lead up to 9/11, Guantanamo, interrogation. But what really interests me about Abu Jandal, if you want to know that, I mean, it really has to do with this interrogation. Like, how is it that somebody, I mean, both, like, the idea that he was interrogated less than a week after 9/11. So as we were all in shock, you know, like, everyone was in shock. This was happening in Yemen, and he was read his Miranda rights every day. And so, what happened to the United States? Like, how is it that we went from that to, you know, renditions and secret prisons and people being detained indefinitely and no due process? Like, I just don't know how we started there. And I think that that's just really important. I think it's also important to understand, like, that there's a spectrum. Like, here was somebody who was ready to die for bin Laden, who took, you know, who disagreed, you know, and felt that these tactics were inappropriate or wrong. And I think that's really important to know too, as we're occupying two countries without any end in sight. If the inner circle is so inner, we're really talking about very few people, you know? And I think that's just important to know. And I think it's just also to get, like, to a different kind of understanding, like, to understand these issues embodied people, I think it makes it less threatening. I think you say, okay, what, you know, where, more like, okay, you can deal with this, rather than this idea that we're gonna be, you know, occupying countries indefinitely.
Right there, go ahead.
I had a question about the scene that he wanted deleted. I was wondering why, I couldn't quite figure out why he wanted it deleted, and then I was wondering if he eventually agreed to have it in the film.
So this is a question about the deleted scene. Why? I'm just curious what your read on it is.
Well, because he kind of said two things. Like, he was saying that he was against a certain kind of attack, but then he was sort of taking it back. So I couldn't tell which one he was more worried about. Maybe he was worried about both.
Right. My interpretation of it is that the reason it's in is because he's somebody who is, you know, he was working for Bin Laden. And that if I was interviewing somebody in the government and they asked me and they were on the record, I think it's on the record. But I think it's also very important to understand his desire not for it to be there. You know, one would assume that if the answer had been yes, I would have participated, that would be the thing you'd want to delete it. Not, no, I would not have participated, and to delete that. And I just, like, I think it shows something about a number of things, like his desire to want to control the film. Like, he's clearly very savvy, very wanting to sort of, you know, mold his representation. I think it also kind of crystallized something about the tension between me as a filmmaker and him as a subject, that it's not an easy relationship. Like, there have been films I've made where there's just tremendous amounts of sympathy or empathy going back and forth, and I think this film has a bit more of a tension around that. And yeah, but did he rescind it? I mean, he's seen the film, so he was okay with it. You know, he didn't bring it up. And I think that most, I mean, the things that are in the film are public, so it's not like, you know, this interrogation hasn't been, you know, on the record. So people, you know what's happened, and I think that he's pretty capable of giving consent.
This is gonna be part of a sort of trilogy of films. You have something in mind for the following My Country, Now This, and then do you have something in mind to follow?
I want to do something in the U.S., like, I think I want to bring it home. Like, I actually think these are all films about the U.S. and sort of repercussions and U.S. foreign policy post 9/11, so, but I think the last one I want to bring home. So I'm looking at different things. I'm interested in potentially the intelligence community. I'm potentially interested in the 9/11 trials if they actually happen in federal court. I'm not so much interested if they happen in military tribunals. So.
What's been the response from U.S. audiences to this film?
You know, remarkably good in the sense that people, you know, we've shown it to a lot of different audiences, and people, I think people appreciate being presented with complicated issues in a complicated way, and there has been a receptiveness to try to grapple with this. So that's great, and it's going to be its opening in theaters a week from tonight, and then we'll be on public television, which we're surprised. I mean, when we sort of realized what the story was, we thought, like, okay, funders are going to run the other direction, and it's certainly not going to be something that public television is going to want. you know. And but we actually got money from, you know, public television, and which is great. I mean, I think that probably wouldn't have happened 6 years ago. I think this would have been a harder film to make.
Have you? Go ahead.
So those are three questions. So I would, first of all, no, I didn't pay him. It would have been a really bad idea. And in terms of what motivated him, there's probably a long list. I think he's somebody who's kind of compelled to talk, and I think partly it's got something to do with like trying to set the record straight. I think he's also compelled by guilt. And wants to tell his side of the story. I think he was, when I started filming, Hamdan was in prison and wasn't coming out anytime soon, and I think he didn't, you know, I think he wanted to, you know, just, I think he does feel guilty about Hamdan, which isn't to say he's to be fully trusted always, and I think that that's part of the film. I mean, I think he is an anti-hero in a very classic kind of narrative sense, and an unreliable narrator, and we hopefully give the audience plenty of clues into understanding that. And the gender thing, I didn't have problems working there. It's actually not a hard place, you know, I mean, it's a little dangerous. I had some problems returning back to the United States. They're not so happy when it's going to
be. You're on the no-fly list.
Came here and it seems to be, it wasn't a problem, so it's kind of, you know.
Have you got any sense of a government response to the film at all, or inquiries, or?
Right. I mean, when I went to show it in Berlin, they said, you're on a no-fly list, you're not going, we're pulling your luggage off. And then my lawyer called the State Department, and they're like, it's not a really good news story for you guys. And so I was able to go to Berlin. But then there have been people who have been reaching out, other parts of the government are reaching out, which is not uncommon, that the government doesn't quite, one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. And I mean, it happened with Larry Wright too, who wrote this tremendous book, and the FBI showed up at his door when he was researching it. And he had the whole chart of Al Qaeda on his wall, and they were like, "Well, this is interesting." But then when he finished the book, the CIA were like, "Can you come in and debrief us?" You know, so it's somewhat similar.
Well, that's good, Laura. It's a terrific work. Thank you so much.